Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis, and this is Literary Viewpoints, and I am so happy that the rain has stopped. The monsoon from yesterday is no longer here, and the sun is shining, and this is going to be fantastic. We have the author of A Life for a Life here, and that would be Linda McDaniels, and we're going to talk about this absolutely, I have to tell you, five-star book, and I haven't been giving too many of those lately, so this one really has a bunch of golden stars. And Linda, good morning. How are you?
Oh, good morning. I'm doing great. Thank you for this opportunity.
Oh, you're so very welcome. This book was really unique and different. When creating the plot in two different voices, and I've been getting a lot of books like that, creating a lot of voices, from the different viewpoints of the characters, did you create Della first or Abbott first, or did you create the prologue and then go from there?
Gosh, you know, it was really interesting how this evolved. I'm not that big of a fan of where the voice changes a lot. And so I wasn't expecting to do that. I was thinking I'd probably do third person and just tell this story. And it involved, Della was the main character, and Abbott was kind of a nice side character in there. And then I wasn't getting anywhere with the book. The third person point of view was kind of blah, and I was real disappointed with it, so I set it aside. And one day when I was walking my dog, and let me tell you, that's one of the best ways for me anyway to get epiphanies about my writing. I'm walking my dog, and I'd heard of this happening for authors, but I'd never had it happen. Abbott said to me, you know, that book could be a lot more interesting if you let me have a bigger voice in it. And I was like, where did that come from? I mean, it was just fabulous. So that's when the book took off. And so I tried it again with first person in Della and this and that. Anyway, to get to the answer of your question, I decided to let them have pretty much equal voice, but what I really wanted to make sure that there was easy continuity between them. I didn't want Abbott to be doing one thing and then the next chapter with Della, she's off doing something completely different. I tried to meld them. So I kind of appeased my dislike of jarring chapter changes by doing it that way. So actually, Abbott came a little bit later into the final format.
Yeah, that was interesting because I've read, I don't know how many books, tons of them, with different voices where there's like 10 chapters and 10 different voices, and the continuity was off where it was like one character's doing one thing and then the next chapter you go like, what? And then it's a flashback and that makes it even worse. No, this was easy to follow. So when you created each chapter, what did you hope to share with readers, and then you blended them together into the character? So why did Abbott, who I love, by the way, he's my favorite. Why did Abbott feel so alone, and why did his father degrade him? You see, when somebody has a learning problem or has a disability, I get really incensed when somebody insults them. So why did his father feel that he kind of degrade him? Why didn't he make him feel important?
Well, you know, even today, now this was set in 1985, so we've gotten a lot better about this kind of thing. But also, as much as I love Appalachia, and I learned so much. You know, I've said in the acknowledgments and that kind of thing that this book really meant a lot to me, to be able to say thank you to the people in Appalachia that taught me so much. This was back during my 20s that I experienced all this. But not truthful if I said that that this kind of attitude about being ashamed of someone with a learning disability, that kind of thinking is a little bit more prevalent, or was. I can't speak for it today because I haven't lived there for quite a while. But when I lived there, there were things that I was sort of surprised that people were still ashamed of, or you know, like the domestic abuse. That was just accepted back then. I bet today it isn't. But back then it was just like, well, you know, that wife just got out of hand, you know, that kind of thing. And I'm not saying everybody was like that by any means, mm-hmm. but it was not unusual to find attitudes that were that I didn't like even back then. But fortunately, I was able to meet a lot of people that I admired. But there were people who had, I mean, this election shows us that there's a whole spectrum of attitudes in this country.
Yep.
And so that's what was going on with his father. He had one of those kind of hard shells around him. Goodness knows what it, I didn't explore his backstory about why was he so bitter about life. But hardship and lack of opportunity can turn people either bitter or make them just want to change their lives. And so there's that whole spectrum again of how we react to hardship.
That's so true. Just like you said, just listening to the news today, it's really sad. I mean, the outcome of the election is whatever it is, but for everybody to do what they're doing is wrong too. And I think the fun part about living in the United States is that there are people with so many differences, and that you can learn from them. And that's what I love. Well, I work with children with learning disabilities, so I know. And no one made fun of anybody, and everybody was equal and the same. And I would never tolerate that. So how did the rest of the people in the town feel about him, and why did they want to steer clear of him? Was it because of his appearance or because they were just afraid of him?
Oh, you know, he had friends at the store. You know, he sat outside of the store when his dad pulled him out of school, and he sat out there, and he had some buddies there and just a hint about the future. He's only 15 when the book starts, mm-hmm. but he grows later this is a trilogy. So later on, he grows into a very handsome young man. So he's not weird looking or anything like that. But
well, that's good.
Yeah, no, he's a handsome young man. So, but, you know, people are just, when somebody's different, if you, there's a real cliquish quality to some of these hamlets, if you will, in Appalachia back then. And seriously, I had neighbors. I mean, a lot of these experiences in the book are real that I had, and then many are fictional. But like when I moved into this very small community, I mean, you would have thought I was from Mars, you know. I mean, it was like, who is this woman who has entered our clan, if you will, you know. And so, you know, and then a lot of them were very warm and welcomed me, like the folks in the book who were like that to me, but or to Della, I should say. You know, it's just an environment in which being different is not, you know, looked upon kindly. And it's like the exact opposite of Greenwich Village. You know, it's not welcoming unusual people.
Yeah, you're right. I've been to Greenwich Village recently too. And and I'm not a different kind of person, but you know, it is. If you don't sort of fit into their community, they stand back from you until they get to know you better.
That's right. And once people got to know me, 90% of them were just super people.
That is great. So tell me about Della. I like her. Why did she give up being a reporter? And what was her relationship with Alex? And why did she need to start over again in a different place?
Well, you know, Alex was her ex-husband, and he had been a philanderer. And so she was tired of that. And she also, now that part was fictional, but the part that was me is I'm Della in the regards of being a reporter in Washington, D.C. And, you know, I bet you know this. You were just talking about this. Those deadlines and those editors that their whole job, it feels like, is to rip your copy apart. And sometimes they make it better, and sometimes you don't agree with what they did. I don't know. It just got to me, it got to her, and so she wanted to do something different. Now, chronologically, I changed things around, but I left reporting in D.C. to go out to a D.C. suburb and open a store, a very fine specialty food store. So it wasn't that much of a stretch for me to have Della open, like take over this failing country store in Appalachia. So you can see I've mixed and matched my story in there, not chronologically, but in many ways. So I had my own store. It happened to be in a D.C. suburb, but I sure knew what it was like to run a store. And then, so back to Della, she was just burned out, you know, and she was sick of her husband, who she loved, but she just couldn't put up with that anymore.
Well, that's interesting, because that makes the story more real and more, you know, cohesive, because it actually it brings it to life better, because you actually lived part of it. And that's unusual to go from being a reporter to owning a store. That's different. So why in Laurel Falls, and who is Cleaver, and why was she so important to Della?
Well, I made up that there is no Laurel Falls. It's slightly based on Linville Falls, North Carolina. And I just made up a town because I didn't want to have to be exact about where every store was and every bank or whatever was. So I, you know, that's the beauty of fiction. You get to, like, you think, oh, that doesn't sound like fun. I don't want to go to Google Maps and have to worry about this and that and everything. So I just made up the town. And, you know, that was a little bit north of where I lived in Appalachia. I spent a lot of time farther south in the Murphy area. That would be the one you'd find on the map. I actually lived in a town called Brasstown, and it was just a fabulous experience, but that's going to be in the sequel, actually.
Oh, good.
And then, so, you know, I just loved living in the mountains of North Carolina, and I wanted to set my book there, obviously, and so I did make up the town to make it a little easier on myself. Now, Cleva is a fascinating character because she is based on a real person. And this person, I met her. We had something called a community cannery. And they don't have many anymore. I did some research on that, and there are not many left. But it was just this beautiful building that you went into. It was owned by the county. And there was a woman there, she was hired to oversee all the canning that we did. There were pressure canners. There were great big pots that you could make huge amounts of blackberry jam and then can them, or, you know, put them in the jars and seal them and all of that. Canned tomatoes, beans, all those things. And Cleva ran that, and she was maybe one of the most beautiful people I've ever met. She just welcomed everybody. She had a big, warm body that she'd just give you this hug, and everything felt right in the world. And so I wanted to honor her with a character in a, you know, the Cleva in the book does things. She's a, you know, has a different background. She's not in the cannery. But mostly because Della wouldn't have had time to go to the cannery. I think it's such a beautiful thing. I might bring that back in the third book and have somebody doing the cannery, because it was one of the most beautiful community experiences, where it was all women who came, but all these women from the community that you didn't see very often would gather there and do their putting food by. And I learned so much about just how to do it safely, how to make jam, what cans well and what doesn't can well. So this is Cleva, and I made her a school teacher and principal just for a variety of reasons, just, you know, because I couldn't fit the cannery into this particular book. But that's who Cleva is.
Well, let's get to the good part, the murder. What happens when Della finds the body in the woods and she finds a note? that's scary, just to walk in the woods and then you see a dead body. And she didn't get too much help from the law. So why did the sheriff assume it was a suicide? And every time she said something, he just didn't want to hear about it.
Well, yeah, I have to admit, I took out a little bit of my anger toward bosses I've had, I guess, you know, who just wouldn't let me be, wouldn't let me try, wouldn't let me excel, or at least that's how it felt. And so I guess I probably, you know, put that into the sheriff that, you know, he's a little bit lazy. On the other hand, he's awfully busy. You know, he's not necessarily a bad sheriff. He just, murders in his neck of the woods were kind of over his head. You know, he didn't want to admit that he didn't know how to look into a murder, and he didn't want the State Bureau of Investigation coming in lording over him. He's an ex-Marine. He's a tough guy. He doesn't want somebody telling him what to do. And so he just didn't want to deal with it. It could have been a suicide. He wanted an easy close to a case. And so he took the easy way out because he really was underqualified to solve that. As far as the murder in the woods, that, you know, when I lived there and I'd go out hiking by myself, you might recall early in the book, Abbott's mother and some other women are always telling Della, you know, oh, don't go hiking by yourself. There could be men out there and they'll murder you and everything. So I have to admit, when I'd go out hiking in real life by myself, I'd sometimes hear their voice in my head. But I never had anything bad happen. I mean, those woods or forests are so beautiful and peaceful. And of course, it was before all the drugs and things too. I hope they're still that way, because it was just a beautiful time to be alone, walk your dog, be out in nature, which is a real inspiration to me. And I'm grateful. That's where I learned it. You know, I was a city girl. I was from Cleveland, Ohio, and went to high school and college in Atlanta, Georgia. And so I just was totally a city girl. And this was just an incredible eye-opener. Both, you know, it was hard and it was wonderful. And so nature just opened up my heart. It was just a fabulous experience. So Della is experiencing that, but she does find this poor dead woman in the woods and finds a suicide note. But of course, that's where then all the intrigue comes in about, was it suicide or not?
That was the interesting part, and she wouldn't give up. But when another note appears and someone close to her is arrested, she's going to prove that that note wasn't written by the same person and who arrested. So how did she go about doing that? Because that was very clever. I mean, here she is, a reporter.
Well,
she's using her instincts.
Yeah, she's a good reporter, but she also has one of the things I thought would be fun is to take people that, like, I've met some fascinating people as a reporter myself. And while all of the ones in the book that she's involved with are fictional, I kind of wanted to honor that I met all these fascinating people, and I thought how fun it would be to be able to call on them if I needed their expertise later in my life. I've never done that, but I just thought, well, I'm going to let Della do that. And so she had done some interviews with this rather notorious forger. And in the book, I explained that he's now helping the Treasury Department. He's such a good forger that they turned him, and he's now helping the good guys, right? But she goes back to see him. Now, I had I don't know why, but I mentioned walking a dog as a way, and being in nature as a way of waking up my muse. But for some reason, the same things happen on buses and trains. And when I lived in D.C., I didn't own a car, so I was on buses and trains a lot. And so I was going to Baltimore one day, and there's a great commuter train that you just take up there. And so I thought, well, you know, I'm going to do a little writing while I'm heading to Baltimore. And Nigel, the forger, showed up on that train. I mean, figuratively speaking, you know. I'm writing, and all of a sudden, there he is. And he's one of my real favorites in the book. And I was married when I lived in the mountains, I was married to a British man. So that's why I made him British, because, you know, I know something about their ways and the way they refer to things and their tea time and all those things. I had fun bringing those into the story. So, and Nigel is going to be in the sequel too. Maybe in all of, he's going to be in all three of them, because he's just one of my favorites. He won't play a big, big role in the other ones, but he'll show up.
Oh, that's good. I like when people bring back their characters, especially the strong ones. That doesn't have meaning, and that they're really good. But I'm so glad you're bringing Abbott back, because he's so cool.
He's the star of the second one. He is the lone voice of the second one. It's and then I think I'll go back to the shared voice in the third one. But Abbott is the star of the second one.
So you're writing it in the first person, then? This is going to be two voices. Oh, that's going to be interesting. Just to hear what he has to say. So why was Bauer was so narrow-minded? He wasn't a bad sheriff. He just didn't believe it. And who is Kit? And why did Della decide that she was a good friend?
Well, that's an interesting question, because, you know, I learned something. Human nature, you gravitate sometimes towards people that are like you. And, you know, it's why we see it's not like it's forced on people, but, you know, there's pockets like in New York, Little Italy and Chinatown and things. I mean, we do that. Sometimes it's like, I'm not talking about the kind that people do illegally and unkindly. I'm talking about just people wanting to be with their people. And so what happened when I moved to the mountains, as much as I really did just want to drink in this different culture and get to know these people, well, like I said, it took them a while to warm up to me. And so when I met other people that were newcomers like me, you kind of gravitate toward them. You may have very little in common, even, other than the fact that they're from a city and they, too, are trying this back-to-the-land thing. Mine actually was in the 70s. Kit was somebody who was like her, a transplant. She had opened this beautiful gallery, and, you know, Della was used to Washington, D.C., that, oh, my gosh, I don't miss all that much about D.C., but I sure miss those beautiful, beautiful museums. And so this was like a touch of something that's important to her. It's someone she can speak to without qualifying what she's saying, so that you know, the two cultures aren't clashing. So they weren't like big buds, but they were like, you know, they'd have wine and cheese together at the end of the day and at Della's store. You know, they'd crack open a bottle of wine and a new cheese and shoot the breeze a little bit. So that was just kind of I think something that's quite human, that we gravitate toward what we know. At the same time, we may be open-minded and trying new things. Comfort zone.
That is great to have a little store like that where you can meet people and just talk. They don't have that up here either. I mean, they have like, you know, they have like a bagel place or bakery where you can sit and talk, but it's different. So who was Mildred? That was Abbott's mother. So why was she the only one that might defend Abbott? He has his mother and father. They didn't realize that he was very bright, and they didn't let him go to school. How come? I mean, he wanted to go to school so badly.
Yeah, well, you know, before I get to his mother, the father, you know, was really embarrassed by Abbott's shortcomings. And I wouldn't say he was really bright. He was really clever in some ways. And he was by no means like a hopeless case or something. He was, but you know, he did definitely have some shortcomings as far as like what he could absorb and do, keeping up with the other kids. And he just needed like a little bit of special ed that they didn't have back then. In fact, the schools didn't even, his school didn't even have a library. You know, I think a lot of people don't realize how one of the things that I particularly loved in Hillary Clinton's speeches was when she'd say, the quality of your school doesn't depend on your zip code. And I would cheer in my living room when I'd hear that, because I think of people in Baltimore, I think of people in Appalachia, they don't have the right zip code for excellent schools. And so that's what happened, that this was a very underfunded county and school system. So his father, rather than have his son embarrass him with falling back, maybe not passing, all of that, he pulled him out of school. Now, you Mildred.
I can identify that because I work with children in a tough school in the Bronx with learning disabilities.
And oh, okay.
Yes, I did. And and the same thing. Oh, they're such a tough school. They're not going to do it. The kids did very well. And I had this little process, like you have your muse. I had my little process in February that I took coffee grounds or something else, and I sprinkled them all over the floor like fairy magic dust. And I said, from now on, you will have no more reading problems. You will comprehend everything, and you will do very well. And they did.
Oh, and I love that.
I did crazy things. I had fun. And, I mean, I taught reading, so children didn't have to come to school till 8:30. Well, these kids came to school at 6:45 for extra help from all the grades, and we in a room that was as big as my thumb, and they brought breakfast, and we did. I taught them how to read from scratch because they couldn't read at all. And in February, I just said, okay, now that you were reading on no level in September, and you're reading like third grade, some of them right now. I said, at the end of the year, you're going to be on grade level, whatever grade is, and they were. It was amazing. They just believed everything, which is fantastic. So there's no such thing as a bad
that's a beautiful story. I love that. And I bet they're doing well today or better today because of you. That's fabulous.
Well, they're on Facebook, and they tell me all the time how they're doing. So obviously the ones that are EMTs or some teacher, one is my foot doctor, actually. And there's a lot of them on Facebook, and if they have a happy birthday, they'll tell me it's because of you I became somebody. And one is following my footsteps as a first grade teacher. She's teaching, and it's amazing because you can do anything if you want to. There's no such thing as where you live or what color you are or what race you are. You can do anything you want if you really want to. And it said that today.
Yeah, but they needed somebody like you to spark that within them. You know, if
they
heard was that they were stupid or whatever, a beautiful story.
And they did at times. So why did Abbott just sit outside the store? This is cool. And I think a lot of people would love to just sit out the store and hang out, listen to the gossip, and do something with it. So why did he find that was interesting? And nobody took his chair. No one.
Well, yeah, because he had, you know, he was a big strapping boy at 15 even, and so nobody was, he had a stare, I remember he'd say, I gave him a look, and he jumped up, and that was his place. He knew he had to carve out a life for himself, a place for himself in this world, and at least it started there in front of the store, which his dad used to own the store, so he felt very comfortable being there. He's in the middle of nowhere, so he can't hop a bus, he doesn't have even a bike, so he can't go anywhere to speak of. So he hangs out there, but, you know, Della doesn't own the store all that long before she starts hiring him to help her. So so he's not just sitting there idle for a long, long time.
Yeah.
He's there, he's chatting, he's helpful, and he likes her because, you know what, she is like the person you are to those kids you told me about. He sees her as someone who believes in him. And you know how you pick up on that intuitively? You just, you know, I had a neighbor. I didn't have the world's best childhood like a lot of people, and I had a neighbor who believed in me, and it really wasn't till I finished the book that I realized that Della was also imbued with this neighbor of mine who I say she saved my life, because she let me go over there, and man, she swore like a sailor. She was kind of bawdy. She let me cook and make a mess in her kitchen because she never had children and she just thought this was fun for an hour or two, right? And so I got to have that feeling of being okay and being good and being welcomed. And that was just fabulous. So it wasn't until I finished the book that I said, you know, I think Della's got a bit of Mrs. Meldo in her. I've since read that, just like your beautiful story, it sometimes only takes one person to believe in someone to save their lives, to give them that spark. And if you have just this neighbor or this beautiful teacher or someone who sees your essence and believes in you, that you're going to make it. And I think that's wonderful because, in other words, it doesn't have to be this Herculean task of saving someone's life. No, it can be someone at 6:45 who teaches you to read. And oh, gosh, it's just a beautiful thing. In other words, we can all make a difference in someone's life. We don't have to be their parent, their teacher, their guardian. We can make a difference with just an act of kindness. And so
you're so right about that. I mean, my mom had Alzheimer's, which was scary. And I walked into to a bakery right after she passed away. And this lady came up to me and she says, "I know you." I said, "Well, what's your name? Just remind me." And she told me, and her husband said to me, "She has Alzheimer's." I said, "I know, I can tell." And she says to me, "I know you." I said, "Well, now you do." And she just walked away smiling. She says, "Yeah, see, I told you I know her." So how did Rollins' door come about? And how did this change everything for both Della and Abbott? And why did Dwayne get away with hitting and beating his wife? That's horrible.
Well, you know, I mentioned, you know, today, all these years later, what is it, 31 years later, we have domestic abuse. So it happens. But he, you know, I have to admit, I tried to give most people an arc. Even that lousy sheriff had a tiny, tiny arc at the end where he thanked Della for how she handled things, you know, kind of letting him take credit and stuff. But Dwayne has an arc too. So I try to have people, one of the things I say about the book is that it's a book about second chances. And I have to have that hope that we can all grow and become better people, and our pasts don't matter because we've moved on, and we're all entitled to second, third, whatever chances. And I've certainly had some second chances, and let's see. But the rolling store. When I lived in the mountains, the rolling store was just going out of fashion because people got their own cars. But what the rolling store is it's like, it can be a truck, it can be a converted school bus, which is the one in the book. It can be anything that takes provisions out into the hollers. Now, by the time I lived in the mountains, that was like people were starting to get their own cars and they'd go into town. But before, just not long before, back in the 50s, the 60s, a lot of people were out in the hollers and they didn't have a way to get to town. So the rolling store came to them. And so in the book, it had been put aside because people were starting to have their own cars. But Della decided to give it a try again. It would give Abbott something to do, get him out and about. It would give Duane added employment. Because let's face it, domestic abuse like that comes an awful lot of times because of frustrations and anger and feeling like a failure. And there weren't a lot of jobs in Appalachia. And so she wasn't doing it just to be a good Samaritan. She was hoping that it would break even. And it did. Mm-hmm. And there's a beautiful scene in there that I just personally love anyway, where when I had my store, I often had things that just wouldn't sell. And I put them in a bin for like a dollar, and they were worth like $15 or something, you know. But I'd put them in this bin, and people would come in, and maybe that's the only thing they'd buy in the store because that's all they could afford. But it really touched my heart that they came in and enjoyed those things. And so she does, she tells Abbott, she gives them a bag of things, and she doesn't charge for them. She just says, here's some things that aren't selling. Give these things away. And Abbott said he felt like Santa Claus giving those things out to people and how happy it made them to get a little gift in their lives. And I don't know. It's just one of my most favorite things. So I brought the Rolling Store back just because I personally am fascinated by things like peripatetic things like that, that where people take them on the road. Like nowadays you'll see people have dog grooming where they come to your house in a step van and they do it all right there. Or, you know, but we don't have much of that where somebody comes to us. And I find that fascinating. So I brought that up and brought it back to life, just because I wanted to, you know.
I think it's fantastic. Too bad we don't have that today over here. You know, it doesn't matter how much something costs, but I know you go into a store and they have a bin of all the stuff that they want to get rid of. It's never a dollar or two. It's a little bit more, but it's fun sometimes just to pick through it to see what you can find that nobody else can find. And that is great. So Alex, she wasn't happy to see him to start with, but why does he come back? Why does he help Abbott, and why does he help Della? And why does that start to change him and her opinion of him?
Well, I don't want to give too much away about the ending. But he, you know, like I said, everybody gets second chances. He made a terrible mistake. And it was a mistake. It wasn't something he did mean-spirited or trying to cheat or anything. But he made a terrible mistake. And, well, he made several, like cheating on Della and some other things. And so, you know, like I said, I have to admit, I want my characters to grow. I don't want them just to be, I guess if I have anybody who's kind of a cardboard character, the sheriff, you know, doesn't have a whole lot of arc to him. But I the rest of my characters, I want them to grow. I want them to change. I want them to honor their mistakes and move on. And that's just to me pretty much the only reason to be alive other than being kind to other people. Those are the two things. Be kind to other people and learn from your mistakes and grow. Those are the two tenets of my life. I'm not always kind to people, so that's where I've got to grow, right? And so I wanted him to have that same experience, and I like Alex a lot. You know, I love journalists. I think journalists are some of the most clever, fun, fine people in the world. Now, I'm talking about, like, people at good newspapers, the New York Times, Washington Post, the Atlanta Journal Constitution, people like that, not some of these wannabe journalists that are spewing hate. But I love journalists. They look for the truth, and the good ones write the truth. And so, yeah, he made a mistake. He got off track, but he gets back on track. And that's when Della starts to know that she's still, you know, well, anyway, I don't want to say too much. But anyway, that they both have an arc there.
Let me just say before I forget, because I'm sitting here with my pen and pencil listening and I'm writing at the same time and learning. Next Monday, I have Christina Haig, Skin of Tattoos. It's about gang-related gangs. It was interesting. I have something very true story. New author, as we know, John Klatt, the Lacey Spears murders. He did an in-prison interview with her, and he's going to talk about that. He's going to talk about why she still thinks she's innocent from killing her child by putting salt in his feeding tube. This is a true story. This book's called My Sweet Child, and everybody should read it. It was, I had a box of tissues in my hand the entire time. On,
oh, my goodness, yeah.
Yeah. The Judas Game by Ethan Cross is really scary. What happens when they turn a criminal to help FBI agents to solve a crime, and he's in jail, he's a serial killer, but they needed him to help. On 12-1, I've got Barbara McNichols, Blood on the Tracks. And 12-8, one of my favorite people in the entire universe, John Land, Strong Cold Dead. And that's just some of what's coming up in December. There's plenty more. And I'm honored that on January 3rd, I'm going to be interviewing Robert Weidman. He's a prisoner of war from the Vietnam War. And
an amazing array of guests.
Yes, we've got tons of them. I never know what's going to happen, and I've got a whole bunch more in December and a whole bunch more in February. But February starts with one of my other favorite people, Brian Friedman, Burn Girl, and oh my God, it was scary. So, what happens when Della's store is on fire, and why doesn't the sheriff? He don't like this guy Bauer. What can I tell you?
Yeah, well, you know, like I said, I guess I was taking out my anger at awful bosses I've had or something. But, you know, he's the sheriff, so he doesn't, he gets involved in investigating the fire. But the volunteer fire department does come, and his Abbott's father does know. What, you know, he's lay awake at night many a night thinking when he owned the store what he'd do if there were a fire. So he comes running and, you know, they get the hoses. Unfortunately, it's a fairly poorly set fire. And so, yeah, but he, you know, that old sheriff, he's a lazy guy. He just wants to call it some kind of, like, electrical mistake or something Della left plugged in or whatever. So, yeah, I admit it. He's a lazy guy.
Well, I can tell that.
Yeah.
We've got a few more questions. Who is Father Max, and how does he come into this story?
Well, you know, I was when I lived there, I was fascinated by all these beautiful, small Episcopal churches that are dotted throughout the mountains. And they're beautiful. They're usually white, kind of Victorian looking, with a red door. And you just see them on the landscape, and you just know it's an Episcopal church. And so I researched that when I lived there. I thought, well, what are all these churches here for? And it was when people in the Low Country, back before air conditioning, that's where when people would they used to. They turned the season into a verb, and they summered there. And so they were pretty wealthy folks, and they went up to the mountains to cool off from Charleston or Savannah or all those hot low country places. And so they brought their churches with them, and they, because they were wealthy, they usually could afford to help the church, you know, build a nice – they're quite small – and build a nice church there. And also, well, old Father Max, he was another second chance person. He'd had some problems earlier in his life, and he was still a drinker. And but he's a kind soul. You know, a lot of people drink just because they're such kind souls, the world seems pretty harsh to them. And they haven't developed the skills to cope with life's harshness. So he was just a kind, so he's just kind of a supporting character, not a whole lot to be made of. He's just, I wanted to bring that in about the churches. I found that really fascinating about people bringing their churches with them, and they've maintained them beautifully, and they're a lovely thing on the landscape, in a kind of especially in Appalachia where not everything is well maintained. They can't afford it. They're tired. When I lived there, I experienced something for a brief time, and I felt very fortunate that I had the resources to get myself out of the situation. But I had a small farm, and I won't go into all the details, but things were kind of falling apart in my life and on the farm. And I got so despondent, and I realized it's something that I coined the phrase for myself, poverty of spirit. And I'd never experienced it before, but I was so tired. I was so broke. In my case, I knew I could get out of it. A lot of people can't. They don't know how. They don't have a family that will help them extricate themselves from the situation, or the get up and go do something. In my case, I left the area and went back to Atlanta for a brief while to earn a decent living. I had that as an option, but if you're like Abbott and you're just there and you don't know anything beyond that, if you don't have Abbott's spirit, you could have poverty of spirit, like I experienced briefly. And I think that's what's happened to his father. His father has poverty of spirit. And I'll tell you, it's the most frightening thing that ever happened to me, because all hope is lost. In my case, I was really lucky that it was only lost for a brief period. But sometimes people don't have support systems, and it's lost for quite a while for them, if not for their whole life. So
I understand what you're saying. Now, there's a couple more questions because we have about 10 more minutes. Why did you title the story A Life for a Life?
Well, you know, at the very beginning, in the prologue, I believe it is, Abbott is reflecting on what happened, and he wants to tell this story. He wants Della to help him tell this story, and he's an older man at that point. And he realizes that somebody lost her life, the young woman in the woods, but he found his life, and he feels a little uneasy about that, but it's like there was a life for a life. He gained his life because Della needed his help, because Della pulled him in to help her with the mystery, because he was given this second chance. And so, yes, a young woman lost her life, but Della, Abbott found his life. And so, you know, if anything good could come from that tragedy, it was Abbott finding his life.
Well, that's what draws you into the story. The book's in front of me. It says, my life was saved by a murder. At the time, of course, I didn't understand that. And once you start reading that, you can't stop. And I'm what you call a very speed reader, yes. And because my mother made me read 10 books every week, seriously, take notes on them and make sure I could report back to her with my little notes on index cards, I never had to worry about writing a book report or a book review because they were right there. So once I started reading this, I said the next day I had to put the eye drops in because I had eye strain because I finished it in less than 2 hours. Because once you start reading, there are certain books that just get you. And when you start a book like that, My Life Was Saved by a Murder, I go like, wait a minute, I got to read the rest of this. And it doesn't happen too often, but when it does, just know that I'm not reading the next day. That's okay. And after that, I said, well, how am I going to read this one or that one? I go, no, can't do it. It's going to have to wait. So what is next
flattered.
For you?
Thank you.
It's a great compliment because you don't get that way. And the good part is also the print's not small. And if the print is very small, I go like, oh, no, that's not fair. Then it takes me a little bit longer because if the print is too small, I need a magnifying glass to see it, which is, explains why Fran doesn't read on her computer ever. I only read print copies. So what would you say, what's next for you as far as the sequels are concerned? Thank God you're doing another one. I can't wait.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, well, I'm working on it, and I've got some general ideas about the beginning and end. And as I mentioned, it's you know, the spotlight is on, the voice is Abbott. He's been to school. Well, I'm not going to go into that because I don't want to talk about how the other one ends. So, but anyway, I'm having fun with it because he gets himself into a, well, he gets lured into the situation that he's getting conned. He's getting, people are taking advantage of him, and he has to get himself out of this jam. And so he does a lot of, he actually leaves his home county and goes on the road to find the solution. And so it's a big kind of coming of age thing for Abbott. But Della and Alex are there helping him on the phone and in person, and there'll be a lot of Nigel shows up, and there'll be a lot of new characters too. Some real interesting people he meets in Virginia, the mountains of Virginia. And so, and he a little bit into Kentucky. So he's going to explore the Appalachian Mountains a little bit more, and it's real interesting.
Well, I would like to extend another invitation to you. It's up to you. I do panel shows. On January 16th, I have one that's already filled. We're going to talk about narration. But on January 30th, I've got mystery writer David McCallop and Bruce Coffin, who's another Partners in Crime author. And for those of you that want to do blog tours, they're the only way to go, is with Gina, Wendy, and Cheryl. And let me tell you, they do the best blog tour. They're great. They don't stop blogging. They can blog me anytime. My books, they can blog anything they want. They're fantastic to work with. And, of course, they just don't ask me if I want to read the books anymore. They just send them. So we just do it. I do the best I can.
I've really enjoyed my experience, too. Yeah.
On January 30th, I'm doing a panel show with these two people, and I'm hoping you'll join us. It's on voice. How do you create voice in your novel?
Sounds good.
I will definitely, I definitely get in touch with you. It's January 30th at, look at my calendar's in front of me, I'm so efficient here, at 10. And Bruce Coffin wrote Among the Shadows, and David McCallum wrote another mystery. And that will be interesting to have a woman's point of view. Women's voice, and how you create women's voices in the story, and how you create male voices in the story. And they're two fantastic, fantastic authors. So before we close, where can everybody learn more about you and your work? And you got to read this book because it's fantastic, seriously.
Oh, thank you, Fran. I have a website devoted to my books, and it's just real simply lyndamcdanielbooks.com. I do spell my first name LYNDA, McDaniel, Lynda McDaniel. It's got everything. It's got the first, the prologue and the first two chapters. It's got all kinds of my blog. I'm going into some of the real life stories behind Mildred, behind different people. And I'm also sharing writing tips because I am a writing coach and a book coach. And like you and I were talking beforehand, I have a fabulous tip for any authors out there. It's called 100 by 100. Basically, you just promise yourself you'll write 100 words every day for 100 days, and it's just amazing, the productivity, because as we all know, it's a psychological barrier that keeps you from sitting down at the computer. So if you're committed to just 100 words, once you're there, you write 300 or more. And so that's when the muse shows up. That's when creativity blossoms. So anyway, I explain how to do that, and I explain other writing tips in there too. So it's a great way to learn more about my characters, and also you know, charge your own writing. So I want to do that too.
Well, that's fantastic because I have my own magazine. It's called MJ Magazine, everyone. And if you're an author that writes writing tips, book reviews, speak out on the election, somebody, it's for writers, publishers, authors, publicists, young writers, I would love to have an article. MJ9 is going to come as my 9th edition. MJ stands for my sister, Marcia Joyce, who passed away. And that's what the network on Blog Talk is, MJ Network, after my sister, who conned me into doing all this before she passed away. It was her idea to do book reviews and radio, and I'm glad she did. But MJ Magazine is coming out at I hope, the next month. So I would love to have an article from you on writing tips, and then I would just put your information about your book and your book reviews going in it. It's going in the
Well, wonderful. Yeah, I can, if you want to take a look at my blogs, I also have, I'll send you an email about that.
Good. That's great. This way I can send you an email about the show as soon as I take care of everything else. That's great. So thank you so much. This is great. When do you expect this next book to come out? Because I have to get a copy before it comes out.
Well, I hope by the end of next year, the end of next year. I don't want to pin it down too much because I find letting something lie fallow for a while and then going back to it really improves the quality.
This was really great. I appreciate it. I will send you, send me the email about the writing tips, and I'll send you the email about January 30th. I do a lot of panel shows, and I have a lot of fun. And the authors Bruce Coffin is great. David McAllop's never done one. It's fun. Mel Corcoran did one last time, and she had a blast. She never did it before. And I've got a whole bunch of people coming on the 16th, Alan Jacobson, Alan Topol, and a few others. It's going to be a riot just to talk to them about narration. And all I have to do is ask one question and sit back and say nothing more. It's okay.
That's great.
So for those of you that want to know some books to read besides A Life for a Life, one fantastic book written by the wife of Magic Johnson, Nicole Johnson, Believe It, Read Magic, was fantastic, absolutely great. An Unexpected Prisoner by Robert Wideman. And for those of you that have watched the first season of The Apprentice, Bill Rancic wrote First Light, which is a tragic love story. And it's probably one of the best books I've read in another one day. It was fantastic. And I am praying and hoping that his publicist will be able to arrange even a short interview with me after Christina's interview next Monday. But if I can't, you need to read it. It's fantastic. So thank you so very much. Everyone, if you don't know what to buy somebody for a stocking stuffer for Hanukkah or for Christmas, buy a couple of books and buy a couple of copies of A Life for a Life. And while you're at it, buy a couple of mine, Hidden Truths and Lies. And don't get too scared if you get caught behind the gravestone. You never know. Everybody, have a great day. Linda, thank you so very much. Cheryl,
well,
Wendy.
Thank you.
Cheryl and Wendy and the people at Partners and Partners in Crime, thank you so much. And have a nice day, everybody.
Bye-bye.